I'm Jerry, I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Jerry.
And I've had the privilege of knowing Christian the whole time I've been sober. I think I had 30, 40 days maybe when I had the opportunity to hear him for the first time. And I'm at a meeting, and I hear this guy just go, blah, 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 in the back. I'm like, who is that? And what is he snorting, smoking, drinking, whatever? And they go, that's Christian. I'm like, oh, okay. And, like, this guy was super-duper excited, and, like, if he's straight. I wonder what was he like when he was loaded. And we got to be friends, and then shortly our relationship grew into, he got to be the supplier. And he would come in, and he was always talking about speaker tapes and speakers, and I never heard it from anybody else. I only heard it first from him, and he would be like, what do you want? Want a little Clancy? Want a little Hightower? You want a little Steve Lee? You want a little this? And he had them all, and he would keep track for me. And I was making, like, zero money back then. And he would, like, I would owe him $5 at a time. My wife would get me birthday and Christmas presents, and he would supply her with speaker tapes. He was a regular one out of Glenwatt, and it was my favorite book study for years. And I think the most integral part of it was him. I always count on him to be the yin of the yang. I've always counted on him to be balanced and be the leveler, the voice of reason. And also at the same time, really know exactly what he's talking about and be the cheerleader. And with that, we'll give you Christian.
I like the fact that he described me as a dealer. Some habits just die hard death, don't they? All right. As many times as I've done this, I just hate the first minute. All right, my name is Christian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7, 2001. And I didn't know what alcoholism was. I just had no idea. I thought it had a lot to do with alcohol. But as I speak to you about alcoholism tonight, I'm going to be speaking to you alcoholism and all of its manifestations. So my alcoholism was treated really well with alcohol. Too well. It was really treated well with cocaine. A lot of other powders, potions, lotions, emotions. Basically anything that changes me from the neck up. I always loved it. My favorite flavor is more. Always wanted more. I always liked that one scene in Cheech and Chong's Nice Dreams where he gets the big bag of what he thinks is cocaine. And he asks him immediately, hey, Chong, man, can I get some of that? And he goes, I mean, it's a bag like this. I mean, it's detergent, by the way. It's not Coke. You know, he thinks it's Coke. He goes, is that Coke, man? You know, he's like, how much? He goes, can I have some? He goes, no, it's got to last me. You know, that's how I was with my drinking and my drug use. So as I speak about alcoholism, you can go to page 7 in Bill's story, and you can go to page 7 in Dr. Bob's nightmare. And they both ended up using drugs in addition to their drinking. And they used it in ways to try to either modify their drinking. I used it to enhance my drinking. I was always a better living through chemistry kind of guy. So it helps to have a first drink. So I didn't have mine until I was 14. Now, I had had sips and tastes, but I hadn't had a drink. And anybody who knows the difference knows the difference. It was my drink. And the very first time I got drunk, I was 4'9". I was a freshman in high school. I hadn't gone through puberty yet. I have since then gone through puberty, just so anybody's curious. And nothing had happened on me yet. My balls hadn't dropped. I had no hair on my body. I felt woefully and painfully inadequate to be amongst all the people that I was going to school with. And everybody was so much cooler than me. I was the class clown. I was always the one who was hyperactive and always trying to get attention. That has not changed. I'm 45 years old now. It has not gone away, thank God. I wanted to be the center of attention, but on my terms. I never wanted to be singled out. And so anybody who's gone through that bully phase or who's been ostracized or who's been singled out, you're going to get a lot out of this part of my talk. It was right before Thanksgiving, and all the cool kids were going to the party. Now, I knew what the party was going to be like. I'd seen Porky's and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I knew exactly what was going to be going on there. And it was just like that. I walk in, and there's stereo playing, and there's people doing this, and people dancing, and people drinking, and people doing this thing out of a long metal glass tube, a long cylindrical glass tube. I wasn't sure exactly what they were doing, but they were exhaling great amounts of smoke, and I wanted to do all of it now. And so they handed me a drink, and I'm going to describe to you, by the way, this is kind of like telling a criminal how to commit crime, so I apologize if this is redundant. They were shotgunning beers. Everybody remembers good shotgunning of beers. The premise is pretty straightforward. You pop a hole in the bottom, and in one fell swoop, up, pop the top, and it all runs down into your throat, right? On paper, it's a very simple thing. I didn't get my mouth, I guess, tight enough against the base of the can, then most of it went down the front of my shirt. But I learned a lot about myself that night. I'm not a quitter. I never quit drinking and getting high. I was always kind of a delayer of, like, you know, the inevitable. And so I grabbed another can, I bit into the bottom of that can, I popped it, and it all rushed down. And something magical happened to me, and I don't know if it happened to everybody who had this, their experience. I don't know if you were 4'9", hadn't gone through puberty yet, but everything on my body suddenly got a little bigger. And the floor was a lot further down from where I last remembered it. My shoulders spread, my voice deepened, and everything got bigger on me. My bravado got bigger, my ego got bigger, my confidence grew in leaps and bounds, and I felt very comfortable doing exactly what I was doing with the people I was with. That was a shift in consciousness that happened as a result of me consuming alcoholic beverage for the very first time and really being able to get the benefits of it. I've since found out that does not happen to most people. Never happened to my mom once. When I got sober, I asked her questions like, so what happened when you drank? Because she would drink like a little glass, you know those little like orange juice glasses you get on vacation? You know, it's an insult to orange juice. It's about that. It's a little bigger than a shot glass. You know, they charge you $2 for it, and you know, and that's all you get. That's how my mom would drink wine. It used to piss me off. Her Chablis or her, you know, whatever. It was usually Chablis. And she would, like, leave some in the bottom of it. So I'm pretty sure my mom didn't understand what I felt like the first time I drank, because I would have finished the bottle. She wouldn't even finish the little cup. So she didn't drink like I did. My brother didn't drink like I did. My dad didn't drink like I did. My dad had some problems when he was growing up. He quickly decided to modify it, and he would drink his little tiny, tiny little glass of Cutty Sark. I mean, a rocks glass, lowball, and he would drink, not an eight ball, a lowball glass, and he wouldn't even finish all of it. That's how my family drank. So when I drank and I noticed the difference, it was stark because it was such a difference in the way I drank versus the way they drank. I just couldn't seem to get enough. And the more I drank, the thirstier I seemed to get. And it was a weird phenomenon. I never quite understood it. I experienced it, by the way, with cocaine, all right? But the difference between, like, somebody who's, like, addicted to something and alcoholism is, like, when you're addicted to something, your craving is satisfied by taking more of the substance. Addicts who traditionally are getting high using opiates and cocaine and speed and methamphetamine, they get what they need from doing that first line, that first hit. I'm different. I seem to want more immediately. I can't just enjoy the buzz. And so at age 14, as I explained before, I was 4'9", and my entire whole world changed. And when I woke up that next morning around the toilet, which was going to be a theme through my whole drinking, I just knew I wanted to do that again. I don't remember painting the walls. At some point, someone introduced Cisco, and I threw it up. Which is, by the way, they should put that on the bottle of Cisco. You know, you may throw up when drinking contents. I did use some of that non-habit-forming vegetable matter that they were smoking out of the glass tube. I learned a lesson first time. You don't cough into it. You know, so I sprayed it all over the white carpet with bong water. So my first time drinking, I threw up quite a few times. I choked on weed, and I had a blast, and I wanted to do it as soon as I could, and so I did. And my entire rest of my high school career went from being straight A's, some B's, to C's and D's, to eventually, the beginning of my senior year, it just seemed like a smart idea to just drop out of high school. And so I did. And then my parents and I came to an agreement, one of the very few agreements we'd actually had in almost 3 years, is that I should leave. And so I did. And then a couple months later, a buddy of mine pulls me aside as I'm living over in Chamblee in a 900-square-foot apartment with three other guys. My rent was $102.50. That was my portion of it, $102.50. I was pulling down pretty good money delivering pizzas, but I had a hard time coming up with $102.50 because I was drinking and smoking all my money. I could barely pay the electric. I could barely pay. My life was unmanageable then, and I was 18. And so a buddy of mine shows up one day. I was really big into, like, I don't know, basically any reason to drink and get high. He says, hey, I'm going on tour with the Dead. All right, so I went on tour with the Dead. I'm told I had a really good time. I don't remember most of it. A lot of parking lots, a lot of back of vans, a lot of buddies making our own little grilled cheese sandwiches. We used to do the kind with a little liquid acid on them and sell it for $20 at a show. People would be like, $20 grilled cheese. He was like, this is a hell of a grilled cheese. Eat half now, wait till drums, and eat the other half later, you know, and they had a very good time. And I had a really cool experience. I moved around a lot. Moved from Atlanta, moved to Columbia, South Carolina. Lived there for like 6 hours. It sucked. Moved to Myrtle Beach. Lived there for a little while. Had a good time. Went to Wilmington, North Carolina. Had a good time. Moved back over to Myrtle Beach for a little while. Moved back over to Atlanta after... I moved to Clemson, South Carolina for a little while. Came back down to Atlanta right before the Olympics. And at this point in time, my drinking had escalated to the point I drank every day. I may not have drunk to... been drinking to a drunk phase every day, but I was drinking every day, and I was using a lot of powder, and I was smoking a ton of weed, and I was doing any kind of thing that I could get my hands on. If you had pills, cool. If you had something else, cool. I was down with whatever. I'm a firm believer in like what Earl Hightower says, you know, about there's no quality control going on in the drug racket. You know, there's nobody over there measuring out, making sure everything's right, you know. But every time I got a drink, I knew what I was getting. When I bought a handle of Evan, I knew what I was getting. When I bought a box of wine, sorry, as a sommelier, I drank lots of Franzia and crappy Cook and all the, oh, it's good, man. I didn't look for labels. I looked for alcohol content. That was how I bought my wine, was how much alcohol was in it. And, 14 or higher was automatically like, I want to drink this, you know. Taste be damned, because after the second or third 32-ounce tumbler, I didn't give a shit what it tasted like. And so I drank because I liked to drink. And then I drank sometimes when I didn't want to drink. And I drank when I swore I wouldn't drink. And I drank when it made no sense to drink. I drank when I was already drunk. You know, I would go down to the, I'd get off work, my last job before I got sober, I was working over at the Ansley Golf Club downtown, and I would get off at 9:30, 10 o'clock. I'd hit the Disco Kroger. I'd get a 6-pack or a 12-pack of beer. I would drink said contents of beer before I'd go to my buddy Spooner's house over in the Virginia Highlands. He lived two stumbling blocks down from the Dark Horse Tavern, and we would kill all the beer that we had. We would smoke all the stuff that we had. We'd go drink. Now, this is pre-drinking drinking. I don't know if anybody can relate to pre-drinking drinking, but it's like the drinking you do before you go drink. My mom and dad never understood that. My brother and sister can't fathom why you would drink to go drink. I was like, you just do. You got to drink to go drink. So we would stumble home, and then I did this repeatedly until I did. I achieved my goal in life, and that was winning the Employee of the Month award. You got to have a goal. You know, mine was that, you know. I was working at the golf club, and they handed me the coveted little plaque and the little thing to hang in the rearview mirror of your vehicle. And they gave me the $200 check. I knew exactly what I was going to do with that money, you know, and I had beer on my breath when I got the award, and I just was like, I've peaked. This just sucks. That was August 6th, 2001. Now, back in 1998, I ended up in rehab, and I did everything that you normally do in rehab. Went to a lot of meetings, heard a lot of good stuff, regurgitated most of it every time I thought I would sound really, really smart in another meeting, making sure, of course, to look around to see the guy that I heard it from over here wasn't in this meeting so I could take credit for it. I didn't do anything to change. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. I didn't work any steps. I tried to live the promises, and that's a painful thing. I did everything wrong. And so when I drank again, I never saw it coming. I never saw it coming. I was a meeting maker. I made meetings. I'd show up right before the prayer. I wouldn't put anything in the basket. I would leave right after the last prayer, unless there was a pretty girl there and I wanted to talk to her. You know, I did nothing to better myself. No service work, no commitments, no nothing. And so when I drank, I didn't see it coming, and I can't understand why I drank again. And so I came back in August of 2001, the day after winning that coveted Employee of the Month award, and I came back in, and I knew a couple things. Number one, I didn't know what alcoholism was. I'd never heard anybody in these meetings talk about working steps or getting a sponsor, finding a relationship with God. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a part we read it in most meetings, and you hear it says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like today. I kind of like a little bit more of what they offer. On page 29 of the Big Book, it says, each individual in their personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. But I like what page 20 says a little bit better. This is the one that got me. You know, on page 20, I'm sorry, page 50. In our personal stories, you'll find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than themselves. And this is the part that got through to me. I'm so grateful they put this kind of stuff in the Big Book. Whether I agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. You see, I came from a relationship with God that was a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. You can do the math on that one real quick. There was a lot of friction in that household. You go to my mom's church, and it was this pious experience. It was so quiet, you could hear a mouse fart all the way across the sanctuary. It was this big cavernous vault, and it was very, very revered. I remember my mom tripping or something when she went to get in the pew, and it was called a Jenny flag. I didn't know that at the time. I thought she tripped. I wasn't sure what she dropped, and I was looking around for it, and then she started counting these beads, these begging beads on this begging bar. I didn't know what she was doing. I didn't have no beads, and I didn't know what to beg for. And then at some point, everybody gets up for juice and cookies. That pissed me off because I couldn't go. She said, you have to stay here. Apparently, I hadn't gone through confirmation yet. I didn't have the catechism experience, and I hadn't gone, and I couldn't therefore enjoy the juice and cookies. I didn't know they weren't eating juice and cookies. Had I known it was wine, I probably would have been pissed off. But I didn't know what it was. All I know is I couldn't go. And I don't know what your experience is as being a child and feeling that pressure to conform, to fit in, to be accepted. Because I lived from that experience all the way until I got sober at age 28, of not being good enough. I can remember the people lining up to get the juice and cookies, and I could feel the eyes go back. And looking at me, the poor heathen who's going to be burning in all, you know, hell for all eternity, and I'm damned because I can't go and get the juice and cookies. I didn't know what none of that meant. I didn't go to Catholic church with my mom on a regular basis, so I didn't understand any of it. But there's a weird theory I have when it comes to, like, when we don't understand something. Remember, like, in Roman times and ancient Greeks, they had this experience of knowing these deities, these powers greater than themselves. They didn't understand the rattling and the sound, this booming sound in the sky. They didn't understand the lightning that came shooting out, why waves would suddenly crash ashore, and they would do the, so they filled in the blanks with these things that made sense to them. Ah, the gods are angry. They demand a sacrifice. Ah, the gods, they are this, you know, and they built an entire religion around this idea. Because it made sense. They didn't understand meteorology. They didn't understand tidal patterns. They didn't understand any of that. They made up things that made sense to them. I do that a lot. But I don't do it nearly as elegantly as they do. I'm just like, well, if I walk in a room and people stop talking, shit, they're talking about me again. By the way, couldn't be further from the truth, you know? I'm the kind of guy who doesn't get hired somewhere or a girl doesn't accept my date because there must be some other reason other than they don't like me. There has to be some other, like, conspiracy, or there has to be some sort of, and I have this mind that just won't quit. Alcohol shuts it down. Alcohol helped me think. Alcohol helped me come up with plans and formulate ideas and then act upon them confidently. Not arrogantly, confidently. And there's a difference, you know? And I felt that way with alcohol until alcohol turned its back on me. And so when I came back in August 7th, 2001, I knew I didn't know what alcoholism was because nobody had ever really taken the time to share it with me and get the point home. That's the difference. In meetings like this one and meetings that I've gone to in the last 16 years, most of the time people are taking the time to really emphasize, if alcohol is your problem, then just quit drinking. But if alcoholism is your problems have just begun. Because alcoholics, as a rule, have a difficult time living sober, comfortably in their skin without something to replace the effects that alcohol used to have on them. You know, that sense of ease and comfort, which came at once by taking a few drinks, we now, if we're lucky, get a taste of that in a meeting. But that's what the steps are for. The steps are a slow, methodical way to replace that power which we lost when we gave up drinking. Alcohol was a power greater than me. Alcohol told me when to wake up, where to go, who to see, who to call, when to stay, when to leave. All the things, alcohol told me to do all of those things. But I didn't get that until I was 28 years old sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was actually at the Heavy Hitters meeting over in Decatur. And these guys were talking about alcoholism as a manifestation of a soul sickness that manifests itself in the way I think and feel. Alcoholism wants me to be so uncomfortable that I pick back up a drink that's going to kill me. And it will lie to me in such a way that it makes the drink seem like the only alternative. It minimizes the damage of the pain in the past. It minimizes the wreckage of all the things that I did while under the influence or in pursuit of another drink. It minimizes all of that. I don't know why it does that. And it amplifies the pain. It amplifies the fear. And so when I take a few drinks, it brings on a sense of ease and comfort. So I'm going to need a big solution. So I messed up and I asked this guy, Don B, to be my sponsor. Don Bryan. Fucking Don, man. Don. Don said, he would say things to me like this. He'd be like, Listen. So I got to lean in real close because whatever he's saying must be really good. And he would say, we recover not by the meetings we make, but by the steps we take. He was a big book sponsor. Now, if I had known he's a big book sponsor, I would have never asked him. That just sounds like a lot of work, you know. By the way, alcoholism is a lot of work, all right? Steps is just a simple series of principled actions that I can take to replicate the experience of the original authors of this book. So we started working steps, and he gave me a commitment. And my first commitment was a triangle Tuesday night big book study. I was to be there at 6:30 and stay until 9:30 because that's what we do. Well, by the way, the meeting starts at 8. But my job was to show up, make coffee, and greet people. And I know what you just heard is make coffee, greet people. What I heard is make all the coffee, greet all the people. You know how many entrances there are to Triangle? All right, they didn't have the downstairs like they do now, but there was the three main entrances up on the top floors, and I'm chasing people down in the big room, chasing people down in the hallway, chasing people down before they get to the bathroom. I'm sweating my ass off. I got the regular pot. I got the turbo pot. I got the decaf going. I got all the stars, the straws, the stirrers. I got the cups. I got everything going, man, and I'm just a wreck. I mean, it's October of 2001, and I'm sweating my ass off. I'm just like, and they're all looking at me real sweet because they're like, you're new, aren't you? And I'm like, shit, how do y'all know this, man? And I was just like freaking out, man. They're mind reading and everything. And I would stay late, and I would clean up, and I would wash pots, and I would empty ashtrays. At one point, you could still smoke there. I remember the good days. I was doing the same thing at Biscayne. I was doing the same thing at Napa. And my sponsor had me busy because I got a mind that tells me all of this is stupid. There's no benefit to it. They're getting slave labor out of a douchebag like me coming in here who's dumb enough to agree to do it. But the thing was, is like I had somewhere to be on Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, and Saturday night. And I had no social skills in this calendar going on in my life at that point. So I had a place to be 4 nights out of a 7-night week. That was a big deal for me because I had somewhere to be. They were counting on me. Everybody's going to die if I don't get the coffee made, you know, because you know how that rule is. And so I had somewhere to be. And he gave me the gift of service. He suggested to me that being of service is the greatest gift that we have in here. Service is the highest calling. That's what we do in here. Now, had he explained that to me, it would have gone right over my head. We have to experience it in order to understand it. Just like nobody could explain their first drink to me before I had mine. I had to have the experience of having my first drink. I actually had a sponsee. It's kind of funny. I was trying to explain this idea to him. And he's been doing it, by the way. He's been actually involved in service. But he was developed a resentment against his home group because they weren't basically awarding him as like service man of the year or something like that. And I said, let me ask you a question. Do you want to hear about getting a blowjob or do you want to get one? Because I wasn't getting through on any kind of normal communication skills. So I asked him kind of point blank. And he goes, I obviously want to have one. And he goes, right. So you have to do the work to get the joy, right? So that's service. You have to do the work to get the joy. Most of the joy I got was not a pat on the back or an attaboy. Most of the joy I got is for 2.5 to 3 hours every Tuesday night. I wasn't wrapped up in here trying to figure out what I was going to do with my shitty life. I had to make coffee. You know, I was very focused on the coffee. You know, my sponsor eventually cut me off from the coffee because I don't need it. So I was doing that for a little while, and then I got another sponsor, a guy named Bill Adams. Bill Adams died from cancer back in 2002, and he gave me the gift of service, too. And I had developed a back problem, and I couldn't stand on my own because I had this pain in my lower back. And he let me crash on his futon, and he was working steps with me. And while he's dying from cancer, he listened to me and my little pathetic problems. I had, like, chapped lip and hangnail problems, you know, and he had, like, cancer problems. And he loved to listen to me. And he was a very flamboyant gay man. I didn't know that. Had I had known that, I would have not asked him to be my sponsor because apparently I had an issue. Didn't know I had an issue, but apparently I did. And I didn't know it. I found out that he was gay in the weirdest of ways. So I'm like sitting on his futon, and like over here is this like bookshelf, right? And on the bookshelf are these big brass penis bookends, right? You know, big, big brass penis bookends. And they're holding books together, and most of the books had something to do with gay lifestyle or homosexuality or homosexuality and spirituality or recovery for the homosexual. And it was all kind of interesting things. And, you know, I was like, that's interesting. You know, kind of a one-sided argument going on over here with this. And then over in the corner was this big, tall, six-foot-tall Glenda the Good Witch of the North from Wizard of Oz cut out. The big, you know, the pink flowing gown. Yeah. So I'm looking at Glenda. I'm back at the penis bookends. I'm back at Glenda over here, and I'm trying to figure this out. And I'm a quick study. It only took me 2 or 3 minutes to put the pieces together. And I look over at Bill, and Bill's sitting there, and he's just smoking a cigarette, just loving it. He's watching me just wrestle with that in my head. And I finally look at him. I said, Bill, are you gay? And he goes, well, I hope so. I got a lot of gay shit. You know? And it's just like, but he taught me that the message is more important than the messenger. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous comes in many forms and many flawed forms. We're so flawed when we get here. And we remain flawed, perfectly imperfect, as we move into this growth of sobriety. And some of us go through things like divorce and child custody issues and bankruptcy and death. And we walk through these experiences sober together, and we see each other at our worst. And it's not our best that brings us so close together. It's our pain. It's our worst experiences that unite us. You can't get this love at the PTA meeting down the street. But you get it in here. You're welcomed in here. Matter of fact, the more kind of jacked up you feel walking in the door, the more welcomed you are. Matter of fact, the more qualified you are to be here. You know? And so I was doing some step work with him, and he gave me gifts of opportunity like humility. And I didn't know I was getting it at the time. And had I known, I probably would have rejected it. But he, like, holding up a grown man in the shower so he can bathe himself. Because he wanted to bathe himself. He didn't want to be bathed. He wanted to bathe himself. He wanted that last shred of dignity for himself to bathe himself. But he couldn't stand up. So he asked me to help him. And then right before he died, as he's smoking his Marlboro 100s, literally to the hour he died, it blows my mind, he invited all these people to come over. And for months, I've been taking care of him, feeding him, making sure he takes his medication, getting to his appointments, doing all the things that you can do to take care of somebody who's dying. And the day before he died, he invited everybody he'd ever basically known, thrown out a huge mass email and made tons of phone calls, and everybody showed up. And he was sitting there. They let him give him a shave and a haircut and do all these great things for him. He wouldn't let me lift a finger. And I was so mad at him because I wanted an attaboy. I wanted a recognition for all the... He'd be dead right now had I not been taking care of his ass. You know, that's how I felt, how incensed I was. And it wasn't until after he died that somebody says, yeah, but that wasn't about you. And it put me in my place. It wasn't about me. This is about him. He wanted other people to have the opportunity to be of service. Because service is the highest calling. You know? He wanted other people to give him a little bit of their God. Because I'd give him so much of mine. And mine was on such a threadbare basis at times. Because I didn't know if I was going to make it on a day-to-day basis. I was being of service, going to meetings like a madman, trying to be sponsored and trying to sponsor. It was tough, and he died on June 29th of 2002, and I was mad. I was over at Peachtree DeKalb Airport that night, and I was sitting there, because I used to go over there and sit, and I still go over there sometimes and just sit and listen, you know, just be still and try to, because the sound of the jets, planes taking off sometimes drone out the sound of my head, and I got a phone call, and by the way, I got a phone call on the same phone number I've had for 16 years. It's a great idea of, like, people staying sober. You get the same phone number. Something's going right in your life. And the guy asked me, he said, you doing okay? And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay, just don't drink. I know it hurts. Meet me at a meeting tonight. And as I hung up the phone, the thought of taking a drink hadn't occurred to me. In the middle of all that pain, the thought of taking a drink hadn't occurred to me. The thought of running, the thought of doing anything radical or painful to my own self hadn't occurred to me. I was in the middle of working my ninth step at that point. I was in the middle of working my ninth step, practicing 10, 11, and 12 to the best of my ability. I was a little less than a year sober. So I threw myself headlong into big book studies. I started going over to Robert B. over at the Atlanta Step Society. It's a thrift store. He was taken through the big book by two guys named the brothers over in Alpharetta, Rick and Dante Rajanti, and those two guys had been taken through the big book by two guys named Joe and Charlie. And Joe and Charlie spent a lot of time working with them individually to help them understand what it was to carry the message. Carrying the message, not the mess. The message is more important than the messenger. And to be a messenger is a great thing, but if your message isn't intact, people can get the wrong message. So we come out of the big book. You know, we don't come out of the 12 and 12. There's nothing wrong with the 12 and 12. Bill was about 12 years sober when he started writing the 12 and 12. All right, it's understandings of the steps after you've worked them, not how to work them. And so we started studying the big book, and I started going to big book studies with them, and I started following guys around, going to the other workshops and all the retreats and all these things. And I was doing these things religiously, all right? I tried dating. It was a fiasco, all right? I met a girl. I didn't go on my first date with a woman until I was 367 days sober. Didn't work out real well. We ended up being engaged about a month later, and she ended up going to the hospital with a brain. She had a blood clot going up the, her vertebral artery into her brain. It was causing what we thought were little seizures, but they weren't seizures. They were mini strokes. And so at one point in time, I'm sitting here watching her dying over at Northside Intensive Care Unit, not sure if she's going to make it out. I made a deal with God. I said, God, if you get her through this, I can handle anything. I made the deal with God in the 8111 parking lot because that's what I was taught to do. Show up where the, when you're in pain, show up at a place where you can reach people who are going to be able to help you. In Bill's story, this says there's scarcely any problem that's not been overcome among us. So at that point, I hadn't gone through a major breakup or a girlfriend dying, a brain death. You know, I hadn't had those two experiences yet. So I reached out to people who told me what to do. They told me how to work it. Go figure, a lot of it is in this book. You know, and I reached out to a guy named Mike Grande in San Diego, and he cried with me, and he prayed with me, and he listened to me rant and rave and go all kinds of places. And from 2,000 miles away, he held me as I walked through that pain. And my deal with God is, God, if you get her through this, I can handle anything. And 3 days later, she got out of the hospital, and we weren't sure if she was going to have function, brain, whatever. We didn't know. We didn't know. But she seemed to be doing okay. And she comes back home, and the first thing she says to me is, she goes, I'm going to be all right. Like, I know, this is awesome. She goes, and I don't want to marry you. You know, she had a coming to Jesus moment in the hospital bed. She was like, I'm about to marry this guy. No way. He's crazy. And so she ended up going back to college. She ended up getting 2 degrees. She ended up getting married, and she ended up having a great family with her. And she's living in Athens right now, having a great big life. None of that would have been possible without God's handiwork. But my deal with God was, if you get her through this, it was one of the first selfless prayers I'd really prayed because it wasn't about me. I just wanted to be okay, regardless if it's with her or not. And my sponsor pointed that out to me in a subtle way. He says, well, what did you pray for? And I told him, he goes, well, you got what you prayed for. I got exactly what I prayed for. It just, I kind of wanted a hook, you know, a little bit on, hey, God, what about me getting the happy ending here? What about me coming out on top? I want the white picket fence and the 2.5 kids. That's what I wanted. It just wasn't God's plan. And so I ended up going to work for a company. I've been there now for 15 years. It's weird being employed at the same place where people have known you for 15 years. It's almost like going to an AA meeting. Less cussing. And, you know, I started working there, and it was they made me an offer, and it was the most money legally I'd ever made in my entire life. You got to use the word legally in there. I was a really good drug dealer for about 2 weeks. Then I was a really, really, really good drug consumer. You know, and consuming your own product really puts you in a bind with the drug dealers. You know, and I started working there, and they gave me these things called vacation days. And these vacation days allowed me to go to places like North Carolina, Tennessee, and Florida, and go to all these different workshops I mentioned earlier. And I started doing a big book study with a guy, and we were over at the Mar Men Center, and we did them on Tuesday nights. And it was such a cool experience to watch our experience with the big book. And our limited knowledge of the big book expand as we listen to what other people's experience with the big book was. And the cool thing I like about the big book is it's not authoritative. It's not an end-all document. At the end of 164, it says we realize we only know a little. And so even the authors of the big book put it in there that, hey, more is going to be revealed. You know, and that's been my experience for the last 16 years. And so we got the chance to travel around and do all sorts of cool things. And some of the amends that I got to make after doing steps 4 and 5, and 4 and 5 was tough for me. I spent 6 weeks writing a fourth step. My fourth step was probably about 6 hours actual writing time, but it took me 6 weeks to get 6 hours of writing done. I probably could have gotten it done in 6 hours had I just put pen to paper and been diligent, it took me 6 weeks. I did a fifth step with my sponsor. One of my favorite promises in the big book is actually in the fifth step promises. And I like how it's just such a beautiful, beautiful thing when it says, we can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. There's a difference between being alone and being lonely. I didn't know that until that day. Being lonely is a feeling. Being alone is a state of being. I can be alone and not feel lonely today because as a result of working these 12 steps, I have a conscious awareness of my Creator in my life. Should I choose to seek Him? Should I choose to seek bills or problems with my marriage or problems with the politics or a state of reunion or North Korea or whatever's going on over Brexit? That diverts my attention. I start meddling in God's business. and I lose my conscious connection. I have a peripheral awareness that he's here, but I don't have that conscious awareness that he's here. And it's in that conscious awareness that I feel the greatest sense of peace. But that, as a result of work at step five, I learned that I could tell somebody my pain and that they didn't judge. More importantly, that they shared theirs. And so now when I'm doing a fifth step with the guys I sponsor, if I don't hear one of two or three things pop up, you know, for men it's usually one of two or three, maybe four things that end up being on their inventory, the most shameful. I had two on mine, and I share mine with them. Not because it's about who did worse, it's about letting them know that it's okay to talk about it. Yeah. And one of my biggest ones that I had, and I didn't think it was a big deal, but it turns out it really was, is I had resentment against the church. Go further, I had a problem with my mom's Roman Catholic Church, and I had a real problem, unfortunately, with my dad's Southern Baptist Church. Because while at my mom's Roman Catholic Church, I wasn't welcome, at my dad's Southern Baptist, I felt judged. I felt judged for drinking. I felt judged for smoking. I felt judged for lying. I felt basically anything that ends up on a commandment, I felt judged for breaking, and I did most of them, unfortunately. You know, and I just felt judged. I didn't feel like I was welcome there. I felt like I was always an outsider looking in. And I hate feeling like that. And so I just didn't want to go. And as a result of working these steps, I realized that maybe I'm wrong. So I started going back to my dad's church with my dad. And a result of that, my dad and I have a better relationship than we've ever had. I remember standing in his face, spit coming out as I'm screaming at him. After I just shoved this big man, he outweighs me by over 100 pounds, shoved this big man up against the bookshelves and screamed in his face, "Fuck you." And we hug and we kiss, and he's my father and I'm a son today. But that would have never happened because I didn't know how to swallow my pride and to do what the fifth step says, is to go to it and illuminate every dark cranny, every dark twisted part of my personality. And I got to share that with my dad. And we wept. The only times I've ever seen my dad cry are about me. The pain I caused him for over 15 years, and now in sobriety. And now we tell dirty jokes to each other until we laugh. You know, I visit him at his church, and he's just doing a great, he's got a really cool life. My brother and sister, we repaired that relationship that was really tough because I terrified them for a couple of years. I terrified them. I lied to them. I broke into their homes. I stole their things. I undermined them at their jobs. I did all kinds of things to embarrass and humiliate them. And they love me today as a direct result of what the 12 steps. I had a really bad time with dating. I mentioned that. I was in like 8 relationships for about between 367 days sober till I was about 9 years sober. I had 8 really crappy relationships. Only got engaged twice, all right? So it wasn't that crazy. Only got engaged twice. I didn't know what I wanted. And I had to go back to that sex inventory. You know, and one of the cool things I like about the sex inventory is that it's about who I want to be in the relationship, not about what they look like, not about what she's got, curves or measurements or money. You know, it's like, you know, whatever my ideal turns out to be, my ideal. And what I realized is there's a lot more than I was selling myself short in relationships. And so I kind of let God pick my wife. I don't want to say that too loosely, but I really felt like that's what I did. Because I focused solely on doing what it was that was in front of me. Instead of looking for the next right thing, which I can't find anywhere in our literature, I just did the next thing in front of me. And I trusted God with the results. That's how I've stayed gainfully employed for 15 years. I've kept a phone number for over 15 years. I've got a great relationship with my landlords, who are good friends of mine in sobriety. I've just got a dynamite relationship with my family as a direct result of doing that. And that's how I met my wife. And go figure, I met my wife carrying the message. I was over at a place called Any Length Recovery in Sumter, South Carolina. It's a big book-centered treatment program. You show up, you get a big book and a sponsor on day one. You start working steps on day two while you're looking for a job. And then you're involved in their what they do there. And they might be considered a little militant to some people. Some people go places and they're told, hey, you can relax by the TV if you want. You can go hang out on the spa if you want. You can go to a meeting if you want. You don't have to. This place was like, no, if you're on campus, you're going to a meeting. And if you're here, you got a sponsor and you're working steps. But if you want to move forward in the little ranks of whatever they do, you're going to work a fourth step and share a fifth step, and you're going to start working steps 8 and 9. You're going to be actively involved, and we're going to make sure that you are. My wife thrived in that environment, you know. She was there. She was blonde. And she had a big book, which I don't know about you. That's pretty pretty damn sexy, especially the blonde and big book part. And something told me to call her. And she lives in Sumter, South Carolina, and I lived in Atlanta. And so I called her. And I don't know what I was thinking I was going to be doing. And she's over there in Sumter. I'm here in Atlanta. I don't know about you. Delayed gratification sucks. All right. I want to touch you now. I want to feel good now. I don't know. That hasn't changed since I got sober. And I was like, this is just so weird. And we courted. Is that the word? We courted? Yeah. Google it. It's one of those funny words. It's like dating without touching. It was like dating without seeing each other physically. We got to know each other. We bared our souls to each other on the phone and with text messages. And we got to know each other. And I fell in love with a woman I hadn't even touched yet. And we did eventually touch. We were in Aiken, South Carolina. We didn't make it out of the the Holiday Inn Express parking lot. Broke a few laws that day, but it was a really good day. It was just one of those things. You know, it's like this is where our passion and interest in each other was not superficial. It wasn't based upon any willy-nilly things. We didn't catch eyes from across a crowded AA meeting, you know. We were connected on more than just some mutual likes. We were in. She is as close to my yang as I am her yang. That is my partner in crime. This is my best friend. She's the best thing I've ever had in my life. And she is just the coolest thing. And we're going to celebrate on December 4th. We'll actually be married 7 years. And she's my best everything. Everything that she is the best thing in my life, and I'm so grateful for her. And she gets God a whole lot easier, getting back to the whole God thing. She gets God a lot easier than I do. She just seems to be able to quiet down and get connected. I have a hard time shutting this down. My sponsor is a guy named John Shires, and John Shires is just as nuts as I am, thank God. But he helps me quiet down this. He gets this. He knows that when I'm in the middle of some chaos, he can hear this because it's coming out of my mouth. And I learned how to share because y'all taught me to. I learned how to be candid with somebody, not necessarily dumping my fifth step in a meeting, but to be candid with somebody. And I learned how to find God with skin on him. There's a guy named Father Ed, not Mutum. No, it wasn't Dowling. It was Father Ed here. He was the one who presided over a number of, and he was a member of the Catholic Church, and he presided over, it was the Air, the JetBlue, not JetBlue, the AirTran flight that crashed in the Everglades way back. And he was a guy here, and he described being in front of his congregation and talking about God and how he would come back into his rectory, and he would pull off the collar, and he would grab a bottle, and he would say, how come I can't get some of the good stuff? They're getting you through me, but I can't get it. I can't hold on to it. And I think we all struggle with that. I think we experience spirituality, but I think it's hard to contain spirituality. And I like how Scott Lee describes it as like we get enough spiritual power for today, you know, we just today. And what the steps help me do is to deal with yesterday and not to worry about tomorrow. So that I can be present in today. And that goes back to Earl Hightower talking about, you know, living between those two, living in the moment, being present. And going back to a line, I can't tell you how many times I read it, you know, thousands of times in different meetings in different ways. And my wife pointed out to me, and she goes, it says, may you find him now. It's not an ultimatum. It's when you find him. My whole world changed that Saturday afternoon. And I was looking at the book. I'm going, did they rewrite this stuff? Man, there's no way. And she goes, that's what it says. May you find him now. And that's what AA has given me. The 12 steps of the practice of teaching, the 12 steps of the principles that we put into action very badly, by the way. I don't know anybody who works a perfect 10th step every day. You know, I don't know anybody who worked. I've never seen a perfect 4th step. I've met people who think they've done a perfect 4th step. You know, you know, but I've never seen one. The only wrong 4th step I've ever seen is the one that isn't written. The only time is ever seeing somebody who doesn't take the time to put it down on paper. And the book says we listed. When I list things on pen and paper, black and white, you know, and I'm not a stickler for the rule. Some people say black paper, white pen, or white paper, black pen. I don't care. It's like my thought is get it out of your head and put it on paper. But until I could do that, until I could share that, until I could take it to God in 6 and 7, until I could not acknowledge how I messed up and the choices, the bad choices and decisions I made that left a pain in other people's lives in 8 and 9, and making those things right. Like I remember making restitution to my mom. And my mom died a year and 8 days ago. And I was at an AA meeting, and my dad called me. And he said, you need to come down to Piedmont Hospital. And she wasn't supposed to die. She was going in for a routine surgery, and she wasn't supposed to die. And we think the doctors botched it. I don't know. But I got a chance to say goodbye to her. Now, she doesn't, I don't know if she heard me or not. I know that I know. And I believe she was there when she heard, when I said goodbye to her. But I leaned in, and my wife started crying when I said this to her. And I said, Mommy, we had nothing left unsaid. You know exactly how much I love you. Go home. It's okay. I'll see you later. And that's what you guys gave me. My mom, at one point in my life, did not want me in her life. I hurt too much to be around. She didn't like it if I was in Cobb County. She definitely didn't want me on her property. My mom used to carry her purse with her everywhere she went from the time I was 7 until I was 29 years old. Even if I wasn't in the house, my mom had a habit of taking her purse. If she went to the bathroom, didn't need anything in it, she took it with her. If she went into the next room to check the TV, she brought her purse with her. And I remember the day y'all gave me, what y'all and this program gave me, trust back with my mom. She let me come over and do yard work. After I got sober, she let me come over and do yard work. She let me do a lot of yard work, by the way. She was never satisfied with the amount of yard work I did. And one day, it was August after I got sober. It was almost a year later, and I was doing yard work outside, and I was sweating, and I come inside, and my mom's purse is on the kitchen table along with a bottle of water, and I'm thinking to myself, she's either dead or struggling to live, because there's no way the purse is not on her person. I'm on the property. Those two were always kind of working together. And I said, you okay, Mom? And I could hear her in the living room. She goes, yeah. I said, you know, your purse is in here. She goes, yeah, I know. I trust you. I had thrown away trust at age 6 or 7, you know. And I got it back at age 29 because of what you guys taught me. You know, I remember them walking into a bank and then giving me a checking account when I was 28 years old. You know, I hadn't had a checking account since I was 18 years old. Because apparently checks in the book do not equate to money in the bank. They burned me, gave me the blacklisted, you know. And I remember getting a credit card in my name. And I remember getting my first car note in my name. And I remember getting my insurance in my name. And I remember going to a doctor in my name. And my car right now is insurance, my license and car title all in the same name at the same time, you know, and they're all valid, you know. It's like, that's what y'all gave me, and y'all gave me a companion to share this journey with, my wife, and with the people in my life, and I think more importantly is y'all gave me a great big God, and I struggle with my great big God sometimes, just because, not that I doubt his power, is I think I just doubt my ability to let go. You know, there's a part in the fourth step in the fear inventory where it talks about trust and rely, and I'm really good on the trust part. I trust that God's got a plan. I just can't seem to relax while it's being enacted in my life. And even after fruition of that plan, I still feel a certain amount of anxiety. And I don't know why I struggle with that. I guess it's just something that I'm going to struggle with. And, you know, Father Ed Dowling, who is one of the key people in Bill Wilson's life after the Big Book was written, he suggested to Bill that you're going to always struggle with this. Isn't it wonderful? Because as alcoholics, we struggle with this relationship with God not being enough. So we're always wanting more. So we've just shifted that always needing more from the drinking and all the drugs to the rooms and to sponsorship and to sponsoring and to God. You know, it tells us throughout the book some of the greatest promises. You're not going to want to miss the lights coming on in a new guy's eyes. You're not going to want to miss it. We know that you won't. We're not a glum lot, you know. People break into merriment and laughter when they hear some new guy talking about their pain. Because we get it. We're not making fun of anybody. We get it. We're just like, come on, brother. If you just do this stuff, you can come over here. And there's a different fellowship that I found. And I found it about, I don't know, about 11 months sober. And it's a different fellowship. It's called the Fellowship of the Spirit. And it's different than the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're a member when you say you are. Now, you may be politely asked or even kicked out of an AA meeting, but you're not kicked out of AA. But the Fellowship of the Spirit is a different fellowship. It's a higher bar of requirement to enter into. And it is as a direct result of having worked the 12 steps, having had a spiritual awakening. I'm now awakened to what goes on. I'm awakened to God in my life. I'm awakened to a power greater than myself. I'm awakened to a solution that will manifest in my life in every which way that I could possibly ever need it, even the ones that I'm not aware of yet. But I have to work the 12 steps to get there. And there's a difference because it's like that being changed from a cucumber to a pickle thing. I'm a pickle, you know, as a result of working these 12 steps. Matter of fact, I think it's even different. I think I'm not a pickle anymore. You know, there's a guy named Don Coyas. He's a member of AA and good standing out in Colorado. And he talks about this difference between sobriety is what we get in here, but well-briety is what we live out there. And I think that's what's so cool about these meetings is that we get to stand up and shake our pom-poms for AA. I had somebody walk up to me once when I was giving out the chips, and they said, "Dude, this is not a pep rally." And I'm like, "Yes, it is. If newcomers could find nothing worthwhile, they wouldn't want it." So when we talk about coming in here and somebody wins the lottery or somebody gets married or somebody gets a checking account or somebody gets the promotion, we're all happy for them. But what we're really happy for is the guy who just went through a funeral, the guy who just buried a child, the guy who just lost a relationship, the one who just got divorced, the one who's living sober while being unemployed. Those are the ones that we thrive for because it's that excitement of knowing that, brother, let's just keep going. Let's just keep going. Come on, sister, let's just keep going. Let's just keep going. Because the reality is to give in is to give in to my disease. I don't choose to pick up. I'm no more or less powerless today than I was when I walked in here 16 years ago. Step one doesn't say that I can't drink. It's not what it says. Step one says I'm going to drink. So today it is just as much about not drinking as it was when I walked in here. I just see it differently today than I did then. It's much more sinister. Alcoholism manifests in so many ways. My alcoholism shows up in, like, late paychecks. Oh, shit. I must have gotten fired. You know? No, my wife didn't return a phone call within a reasonable amount of time. Ah, she's cheating on me. You know? That's my disease tells me that. I have a disease that tells me the most insane things in order to cause restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. So it can get me thirsty again. Because if I'm thirsty long enough, I'll drink. And if I drink, I'm gone. I'm not powerful over that at all. What I'm aware of today is that unless I keep God in my life today, unless I practice these principles every day, unless I stay connected to you guys every day, I will eventually get the rids, and I'll eventually walk out. And I'll think it's a great idea while I'm doing it. So I'm grateful for the Primary Purpose Group for doing one amazing thing, and that's carrying the message. Not the mess. A lot of weird messengers are going to come up here on this podium over the next couple of years, Jerry being one of them. You know, this is what, the sixth or seventh time I've spoken here, you know, and I don't know if I've ever shared the exact same 45 minutes from the podium as I have. I don't have a rehearsed talk. I've been sober longer than I was drunk. So today I got a whole lot more about good stuff than I do about the bad stuff. You know, I'm really grateful for what Alcoholics Anonymous has done. I'm really grateful for what God has done. And I'm really grateful for y'all for introducing me. So thank you.